Think about love. A knock at the door and it's the delivery man with flowers. That flutter in your chest when you see their name pop up on your phone with a text. The smell of melted chocolate when the waiter brings around dessert on date night. Think about love. The whole family cuddled up by the fireplace, the warm weight of the baby asleep on your chest. The 200th lunch date with a lifelong friend still going strong. When we experience love in our lives, in any of its forms, we long for the moment to last. We revel in it and think to ourselves that this is the way life should be. You were made to long for love. The kind of unconditional love isn't winding down or temporary or contingent on performance. A love unfailing and bottomless, a love stronger than death that looks on tempests and is never shaken. Love is brave. Love came down from heaven as a baby, born in a barn to young, frightened parents at the outskirts of society. Love took human form as a humble carpenter who became homeless and spent his time with the lame, the sick, and the despised, only to himself be rejected and despised, and yet still go on loving those who hurt him. You were made to long for supernatural love, the kind that compelled Jesus to leave his glorious throne in heaven, to take on our human frailty, and to be okay with it all starting in a cow's feeding trough on a cold night in Galilee. That's the thing about love. It will take you places you never thought possible. This Christmas, through Jesus, we have love.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Harvest Bible Chapel Advent Podcast. I'm Pastor Luke McDonald, and over the next 4 weeks, we are going to look at each one of the themes of Advent: hope, love, peace, and joy. In a different way than maybe you've heard before, we're going to try to use story and song and poetry and words of every kind to help us understand the beauty and the power of what Jesus Christ did for us that very first Christmas that lives until today. And so to start out today, which is our love episode, we're going to hear a story of a couple who is right now in Chicago, all the way from Africa, training to be pastors, who encountered God's love in ways neither one of them could have ever expected. Check this out.
Peter and Jolene are in the training center with Harvest Bible Fellowship. Peter actually already has a church in Uganda, which will become a harvest when he's completed the training. We spoke to his wife, Jolene, at the Elgin campus. At the moment, Peter is back in Uganda, sorting out something with their visas. He joined us via Skype. You may notice that not only is he communicating over a Skype connection, he also seems to be in some sort of reverberant room. Here's what he had to say about that.
Before I tell you, I left the place I was seated and came into a quiet place, and guess what it is? I am in a toilet.
Anyway, just thought you should know that. Peter grew up in Uganda. He became a Christian in September of 1999 after he saw a film called Heaven's Gates and Hell's Flames. And you know, some people, when they get saved, they just sort of keep living their life. They go back to their same job, they have a renewed sense of purpose, a new framework for living. It's all very calm. But not Peter. He describes his post-conversion mode as being on a rampage.
I was on a rampage to win the whole world for Christ and told all my friends and all the villages and went to the war-torn areas.
In the war-torn villages, Peter saw starving children who had been shot, lying in the street bleeding with no one tending to their wounds. He knew Christ was calling him to love and serve those children. He got a day job at an accounting firm, and he would use his days off to go into the northern war areas and preach the gospel to children. Or he would go to the islands of Lake Victoria to bring Bibles to the people there who didn't own any copies of God's word. He went into some villages where children were being castrated or decapitated and sacrificed by witch doctors. And so he eventually started a refugee house for children who had been victims of mutilation in attempts at child sacrifice. One day, Peter was going to town on his motorcycle. It was raining, and he saw an infant, no more than a few days old, who had been tossed onto a rubbish heap on the roadside, barely alive. An old woman had also just arrived on the scene, and they worked together to save the child.
I sat with her, and together with the old lady on the same motorcycle, we went to the police first and told them. And then they told us rush to the hospital, so we went to the hospital. And the hospital we went to, they said they couldn't manage the child. They thought the child was actually dead. And I told them, no, she's not dead. This is, well, she looks like she's dead. So I left the hospital, went to another hospital in Kobe, in town, which had nurseries, and they admitted the child.
So just to be clear, the hospital told him the child was dead, and he said, no, she's not. And they said, well, she looks dead. So he had to go to a completely different hospital to get help. I can't fathom that. Anyway, the baby stayed at this new hospital for a few months, and when she was discharged, Peter was, of course, too busy working and preaching to look after the child. So he went to the old woman who had gone with him to the hospital the day they found the child, and he made her a deal.
I said, I would like to look after this child, but would you look after her for some time? And she agreed, and she said, if you will facilitate me financially, I would care for the child. So she stayed with the child. I bought all the things that she needed, and I kept on checking on the child every day, not every day, but most of the time, buying her food, buying her clothes, buying her stuff. I knew that I would want to adopt her, but then because I was single, the government doesn't allow us to adopt when you're single.
Eventually, the old woman died, and Peter took custody of the child with some help from his mother and his sister. As he mentioned earlier, he couldn't officially adopt her yet because he was single, and the Ugandan government does not allow unmarried men to adopt children. So he cared for her as his own, and he named her Malaika, which means angel. So that's Peter. Jolene claims her story isn't as interesting, but I beg to differ, and I think you will too. She was born into a Christian family. Her father was the most famous pastor in Uganda in the 1980s. He had gone to Bible college when he was 15, sort of a prodigy. Today, he hosts Christian events in the largest stadiums in Uganda, attracting hundreds of thousands of people. He also acts as a liaison between church and state. So when the Ugandan government is having trouble with the church, he steps in and mediates. He's a busy guy. And Jolene says growing up, it wasn't always perfect.
My father loves us, and I know that he is a very loving father, but there was a lot of time he sacrificed, even now, to spend time with the church and doing God's work than with us. So we spent a lot of time with our mother. So we have grown up with people in the church, seen how much people can really love you or can really hate you in the church, been through it, been hurt, gotten back up.
In 2008, while she was in college, Jolene met Peter. He was charming, charismatic, sort of a mover and a shaker, but it wasn't exactly what you'd call love at first sight.
Whenever I would call her and say, hey, can I take you out for dinner or lunch? She says, yeah, sure. She would probably take a long time. I'll call you back. And then she says, okay, we can meet. And then I would come from the village to town. Sometimes I'm late and she's super early on time. And she's all fully dressed up, and I'm in my rusty, dirty clothes, sometimes smelling. I had a very old car that always broke down, and she would look at me from head to toe and say, did you just come for dinner? And we would go for dinner and literally just look at each other, and then she'd be like, take me home. I will gladly drive her home, and I know for sure I'm not going to see her again.
On their second date, the car broke down on the side of the road at 10 o'clock at night. When Peter told us this part of the story, the Skype connection was interrupted, and some of the details were garbled. So I'll tell you what happened at that part, and then I'll let him pick it back up. Basically, he tried to fix the car, and nothing would work. He actually at one point asked her to get out and help him push the car home. She wouldn't do it. So they sat there for a long time.
Eventually, I got out and went, laid my hands on the engine and started praying. And went back into the car, and it was just one geek, and we left. And she told me, take me back to school. She was in university. So I took her back to school. She did not even say goodbye. She opened the door, banged it, and left.
Peter and Jolene didn't speak for 6 months. He figured it was a lost cause. But one day, he decided to call her up one last time, asked if she wanted to go out to dinner. This time, he borrowed a friend's car. It was newer and much nicer, but he forgot to check the fuel gauge, and on the way home, he ran out of gas in the middle of a traffic stop.
It was about 7 or 8 p.m. And I'm like, please help me push the car so it gets out of the road and I can go get gas from here. And she refused. And I ran out, went, got gas and came back and drove her back home. She banged the door again and didn't even say goodbye. And said, never ever take me out in your old cars. I knew for sure that was gone.
There were other complications, too. Remember how Peter had started a home for children who had been mutilated in attempts at child sacrifice? Apparently, he sometimes brought a few of them with him wherever he went.
at some point, I remember when we met in 2008, most of the time he would come to dinner or lunch and show up with these kids. And I'm like, Peter, really? You have come to ask me out and you have shown up with these kids. And we are not even talking about what matters. We are just looking after these kids and asking them what they want to eat.
There was another problem. Peter was a preacher.
Told Peter when we met, I told him one of the first things he got to know about me was that I didn't like pastors. I am not interested in being a pastor's wife. I'm not interested in adopting children because my parents have adopted even more than 12 children. I know that there was a time in our house we had even more than 25 people in the house and we had to live with them and love them. So I told him, I don't want that kind of life. If I get married, I want something totally different. I want an 8-to-5 job. I want an 8-to-5 husband. And I want everything to be different. So, you know, it's just amazing how God changes our plans.
Peter and Jolene started talking about marriage, but they still hadn't worked out what they were going to do about Malaika. Then one day, there was a prayer meeting in the afternoon at Jolene's parents' church. It lasted from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, and at about 4 o'clock, the ushers were sweeping up the church, and they heard the sound of a baby crying. Someone, who must have known about the prayer meeting, had hidden a baby girl behind the curtains and abandoned her.
When we took her to hospital, they suspect she might have been about 2 or 3 days old because she still had her umbilical cord on. She was very, very young. So, of course, the right thing to do was report to police, and then my parents had traveled on vacation at that time, so it was myself and my older sister that were going to take charge of that case. So they called us and said, oh, there's a baby that has been abandoned and you have to take her to the orphanage. I called my mom and said, you know, this is what has happened and we don't know what to do with the baby. So she said, well, Jolene, I've trained you well. You've grown up seeing children and since you're jobless right now, I'm asking you to take charge of the situation, look after the baby until we come back. Then we'll see what we can do from there. So we took her home, and she told me not to put her with the kids at the orphanage because she didn't know what infections they had or what would happen to the baby. So I had the baby in my room, in my parents' house, and I was like a mother. I had to feed her, I had to wake up in the night, and, you know, I had this baby, basically. So I called Peter and told him about what had happened. But at that time, it was just like, I'm just helping my parents do this. When they come back, they have to take charge. My parents got back when Kayla was about 6 weeks old. But at that time, I had really bonded with her. I could see, like, every day, just spending every day with this child just brought me closer to her. And it was very difficult when my mom told me, oh, now we have to move her back to the orphanage. And da, da, da. I said, no, I'm not going to take her. I think I want this child to be my child. And 2 days before that, I had had a dream. Actually, before Kayla was even abandoned, I had a dream that I was trying to adopt a child. And the government was saying, why are you still in your parents' house? That is the only reason why you can't take the child, because you're still in your parents' house. So I called Peter and told him, this is what happened. Now, before Peter traveled, I told him, Peter, you're traveling, but I want you to know, if there's any American that wants to adopt a child, Malaika is available, is up for adoption. And he said, I'm not giving her up. Actually, if it means us calling off this wedding and us breaking up, it's okay. I don't mind that, but Malaika is in my life, and I want to be her father.
Just to be clear, Peter is caring for this child, Malaika. Peter and Jolene want to get married, but Jolene doesn't want to adopt children. She doesn't feel ready. She's telling him, you know, you got to give Malaika away. And Peter says, no, she's in my life. God put her in my life. I love her. This is a deal breaker. I won't let her go, even if it means calling off the wedding. Meanwhile, in the middle of all of this, a baby gets abandoned at Jolene's parents' church. And because her parents are out of town, she's in charge of the situation. She falls in love with the baby and wants to adopt her. So now they're equal. Love found a way. Peter and Jolene did get married. And their parents actually took care of the two children for the first 6 months of their marriage so that Peter and Jolene could get to know each other. Then they adopted Kayla and Malaika, and they also had some of their own biological children.
God has really changed the way I think, the things I want, and it has made me realize that actually it wasn't what I was planning, but rather what I was desiring. It was, this is what Jolene wants, this is what Jolene wants, and this is what Jolene should get. But God was saying, this is what God wants for you, Jolene.
Do you have a favorite Christmas song? I don't mean like Hark the Herald Angels Sing or Angels We Have Heard on High, one of the old ones, but do you have a modern favorite Christmas song, the one that you seem to play over and over and over? I do. It's from my friends John and Valerie Guerra. It's called Lord Remind Me, and I think it paints an awesome picture of God's love. Listen to this. This is from their album, It's Almost Christmas.
When children play on Christmas Day and snow is flung, when I feel I haven't had a friend since I was young, when I'm feeling tired of myself and everyone, Lord, remind me, Lord, remind me that the shepherds heard the angels break the silence in the field, that the wise men found a baby they could not help but kneel, that the one who heard our weeping became a child in manger sleeping. Lord, remind me, 'cause it's Christmas and I want to remember. When I hear the news and hear another war's begun, when I wonder if God's on the side of either one, I hear bullet, nail, or handcuff, you bore all of them. And in the light, my heart's as dark as anyone's. Oh, oh, Lord, remind me, Lord, remind me that the shepherds heard the angels break the silence in the field, the wise men found a baby and they could not help but kneel, that the one who heard our weeping became a child in manger sleeping. Lord, remind me, 'cause it's Christmas and I want to remember. Tell me how he loves me, tell me how he wants me, tell me the story like I've never heard before. And I'll sing it like the angels sing it, with my whole heart sing it to him who's worth a thousand songs. Beside you is with you now and waits for me, that the cry of faith so simple is the greatest song in heaven's hymnal. Lord, remind me, 'cause it's Christmas and I want to remember.
Ashley Anderson is a licensed clinical therapist living in Chicago. She attends the Cathedral campus. Her husband Neil is an elder at Harvest, and we wanted to talk to Ashley about this week's Advent theme of love. I think of all the different weeks of Advent, love is perhaps one of the trickiest. The reason being, it's such a broad term. People will say, I love the Cubs, I love cheesecake, I love God, I love my children, I love my spouse. But we know that all those loves are different. So we wanted to ask Ashley about love, specifically about the four loves, which are described by C.S. Lewis. Here she is. Thanks for coming, Ash.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
We actually also have the same parents, so there's that.
There's that.
Uh-huh. That might kind of come in. So why don't we start with the first one, Ash? We'll go through each of the four loves. The first one is called storge, or familial affection. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so family love is found between family members. So people who have found themselves bonded by chance, the families that we're born into, our parents, our siblings, our grandparents. This kind of love pays the least amount of attention, typically, to the characteristics deemed valuable or worthy of love. We just love each other because we're family.
As a therapist, what do you notice can happen when, you know, among patients who lacked this kind of affection in childhood?
So what you'll see when people lack family love from the beginning is you'll see problems and dysfunction in every other relationship. So today we're going to talk about family love, friendship, romantic love. You'll see problems in each of those areas. So a lot of us will experience struggles across the board in relationships, and typically that will often come back to this very start in our lives of pain and difficulties with family love.
Hmm. And how can that be mended? I mean, what kinds of issues do you run into, and what do you tell people who need to get that straightened out? Because it's like something you can't do anything about. It's like you were born into a situation and nobody asked you.
Right, absolutely. I think that the primary way that this is mended is through awareness. So, for example, if you had pain in your body, it would be really important to identify where that pain was coming from and to examine it, get an examination, and figure out what's happening here and what are the effects and what needs to be done. And in the same way, I find that family of origin pain for people is hugely addressed just by the awareness. Many people go through their lives struggling in every aspect of relationship, just like I was saying earlier, without ever understanding why, without ever having any insight as to where this all began. And so the simple step of awareness and beginning to open your eyes to where these issues might be coming from sheds a great amount of insight in and of itself. And I think that the other steps of healing unfold after that.
Well, let's move on to the next one. And we'll circle back to these at the end once we've talked about God's love and sort of how it informs and redefines these. So, but from the sort of scientific realm, the next kind of love that's described in Greek thought and in a lot of other cultures is called philia, or friendship. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how that's different from familial affection?
Yes, yeah, so friendship exists between people who have chosen each other. So just as we were saying that families most often do not choose one another, friendship exists between those who share common values, common interests, activities. It's chosen often just based on like. Mm-hmm. It's chosen based on enjoyment of one another. And in some ways, people will consider friendship one of the highest loves because of this, because it's freely chosen. I'm in friendship with you because I just like you.
Right.
And that's a really powerful and special thing. So I'm looking forward to talking about that today.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like friendship is, I think one of the things Lewis says is it's two people side by side. sort of admiring the same thing. In your experience, why is friendship important for mental health, and why do so many people seem to lack it in a true sense?
Mm-hmm. Friendship is important for our mental health because it provides the scaffolding that our lives need. It protects us from the isolation that we were not intended for. It provides the presence, the support, the perspective, the accountability that our lives need. I believe one of the most important aspects of friendship is that it protects us from ourselves. It provides, as I was saying, that accountability. It provides another perspective.
Right.
It provides groundedness. And I think that people find friendship to be a difficult area in their lives.
It's so hard.
And I've thought quite a bit about this. And I think that friendship is so hard to find because we're looking for it instead of cultivating the qualities that make it successful. I think the number one qualities that make friendship successful and meaningful are listening skills, vulnerability, resiliency. By resiliency, I mean the ability to say, oh, I don't think you got that. I don't think you got what I was saying, instead of walking away and crawling away from that friendship to go back and say, you know, let me try that again.
Right.
Can you hear me again? And can we reach connection? And oftentimes, I think we struggle with some of those qualities that we need to make friendship successful. And so I think it's important to shift our focus from looking for friendship back to what I was saying of cultivating those, abilities that make it meaningful and successful.
That's great. I appreciate that you said vulnerability or accountability, because I was just telling a friend the other day that I think one of the important reasons to be in a community of people that aren't your spouse or aren't your family is that those are important too. But friendships create this web of relationship that habituates self-restraint. Like you said, if you have friends who are checking in with you, you're less likely to do something ghastly, which might be kind of an extreme example. Mm-hmm. But it's good to have these kind of webs of relationship that protect us from I think you said they protect us from ourselves.
They absolutely protect us from ourselves. And you may say we have our families, we have our spouses, but the thing is, in those situations, our families are all coming from one perspective, ultimately, right? There's many, many blind spots in any given family.
Oh my goodness.
And there's many, many blind spots in any given marriage. And so I think that's where friendships are so beautiful, because you have people coming from entirely different backgrounds, entirely different situations that can really offer you a greater level of feedback and groundedness than simply your family or your spouse could alone.
So then we have Eros, or Eros, E-R-O-S, which is romantic love. Tell us how that's different from familial affection and then friendship, which is philia.
Mm-hmm. I think that romantic love is definitely one that we all recognize is very special, and one that many people are seeking throughout their lives. And I think that friendship, the ultimate form of Eros, is when friendship can flower into Eros. And then the commitment that God instructs of us to be in a covenant relationship with one other person for life is something else that really makes romantic love special and different from the other relationships.
Yeah, I think in a way, like Eros and philia, like without Eros, none of us would be conceived. And without philia, none of us would be reared or raised. But friendship, again, kind of like has no biological implications.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of extra, but you've just sort of validated it in all these other ways. I think the other confusing thing about Eros is that people think it's purely physical, like that it's a scientific thing, that it's just something we share with the beasts. But one of the things Lewis says about Eros is that it's a man may be in love with a woman not so much because she is a woman, but because she is herself. Like it values the soul.
Yes.
And then it has around it this other sort of biological component. What about the sort of mystical union between Christ and the church and the relationship to Eros? Is there anything you want to say about that?
Well, I think that scripture lays that out as one of the foundational principles of this whole relationship. And in that way, it's really unique as well from the others. And it is in Eros that we learn that beautiful biblical balance of respecting, like you said, another person just for who they are, sacrificing for them, loving them completely as just who they are. And I think we'll see in marriages, I believe that you can see the difference between what you were saying earlier about C.S. Lewis's line about loving her because she's a woman, mm-hmm. Versus loving her because of who she is. And I notice the differences in marriages between those two different perspectives. I would say one is not all the way there and the other one is more complete.
The fourth kind of love, which would kind of colors in the others, which is agape. And that's God's love for us. It's a spiritual love. It's supernatural. What do you have to say about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, agape is what we all understand to be God's unconditional love. And it's not one of the natural loves. It's supernatural. It goes against our very natures. It loves the unlovable, the undeserving, the ugly. And it is something that is required to redeem our brokenness in all of these other loves that we've been discussing today.
Talk about that. Like, how does it inform the others?
Well, I believe it was Pastor James who said, without forgiveness, there would be no enduring relationships. And so the aspects of agape, the unconditional love, the forgiveness, the giving of oneself, those sorts of principles are necessary for any of these other three loves to endure: family relationships, friendships, marriages, romantic love. We need the agape love that God gives to us and shows to us as an example. We need that in order to sustain and maintain all of these other relationships.
We asked Ashley what love looks like during and after a tense political season. We're headed into the holidays. People, you know, might find themselves in situations with loved ones they disagree with. Here's what she said.
Well, I think that one of the misunderstandings about love is that in order to love each other, we all have to be the same. And love should always be combined with truth also, as taught by Jesus. And I think one of the aspects of truth to understand in families, in friendships, is just the aspects of healthy family dynamics. And healthy dynamics create room for differences in any family, whether that's amongst the adults, amongst the children. There needs to be room for people to feel differently and to think differently. And so I think there's that misconception that love means we all have to be the same. And I don't think that that's true.
We talked to Ashley about love in the Christmas season, especially the theme of sacrifice, remembering how Christ emptied himself to take on human form and how we should follow Christ's example and seek to be sacrificial in giving to our loved ones. But she also highlighted something else that you maybe don't hear as much about.
Christmas is a really good time to reflect on your ability to receive. And in relationships, something that I've come across as a counselor is that many, many of us understand the importance of giving. Fewer of us understand how to receive in a relationship. And without both, the power of the relationship is rendered neutral. So in the same way that God requires us to accept the gift of his Son for anything powerful to take place, it's the same in any friendship, in any marriage, in any family, to be able to be on the receiving end of love, to be a wife that will actually receive and accept her husband's compliments and not respond with, no, that's not true, and, you know, just total resistance. That renders the power that the husband could give to the wife as, you know, neutral. She won't accept it. There's definite value this season in thinking about how comfortable you are with receiving and are you able to receive from others.
Well, so you counsel a lot of people who are outside of the church community, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. people who are still investigating the claims of Christ. Mm-hmm. How can people who have someone like that in their life, like they have someone coming home for Christmas who's still investigating the claims of Jesus, they have someone that they're going to be at the holiday party with at work or outside at some club or whatever, and they want to show them love. What are some like ideas for the Advent theme of love, and how do we communicate what we know about agape? Because they all have got these first three. They all had a family. They've all hopefully got friends, even though we talked about how that might not be true. And usually they have had some experience of romantic love. But this fourth category of unconditional love, they may not have experienced. What's a way to talk to them about how our first three natural loves are like superseded and transcended and transfigured, if you will, by these others?
Well, what I've found in talking with people who don't know Christ, don't understand his ways, is that the most powerful kind of love is the love that lays down oneself, because that is not a principle that the world is familiar with. And that's also not an aspect of love that is practiced. And so loving someone in a way that lays down yourself, whether that's listening, devoid of self-interest, and truly connecting with someone by putting yourself in their shoes, and the emptying of self that that requires just for the moments of the conversation, are really, really powerful. And I think that we can show Christ to people through those types of interactions.
I think what you're talking about is the incarnation. You're saying don't go to someone and be like, here's what love is, here's who Jesus is. You're saying empty yourself the way Christ did and just be a vessel that receives what they're saying and listen to them and like let them experience Christ like in flesh rather than as this abstract idea. This is how we're different. This is how we think about stuff. You're saying don't even go there. It's right. Like spread the gospel using words if necessary.
Right. We are the body of Christ, and I believe that that's what that means, is that we live out the way that Christ would live. And people are unfamiliar with that. They may be familiar with our claims.
That's true.
But they're unfamiliar with the experience of interacting with someone who treats them like Christ.
So I think my favorite biblical description of love comes from Ephesians chapter 5. Paul does what people usually say you shouldn't do. He helps to show us what love is by describing what it isn't. He gives a really clear example to all of us of what love isn't and what love is, and I think it's really helpful and significant for us this Christmas. He starts out by kind of saying in verse 3 about how you don't get mixed up with sexual immorality, don't get mixed up with impurity, don't be a covetous person, because those things shouldn't even be named among you. That's not what's proper for a person. And Paul does this thing that sometimes my mom does. When my mom is trying to make a point, she says what she wants to say, and then she says it again and changes maybe one word, and then she says it again a little louder, and then she says it again, maybe changing two words. She just keeps saying the same thing over and over and over. And in Ephesians chapter 5, Paul says the same thing like four or five times. He says this: love does not equal casual sex. Fulfillment sexually outside of marriage is not love. And he says love doesn't equal sensual words or sensual behavior. The jokes, the innuendo, the always finding a dirty way to think about something, that is not love. Love doesn't equal casual sex. Love doesn't equal sensual words or behavior. And then he kind of takes a left turn, but he does it three times in a row, so you know it's on purpose. He also says that love is not covetous thoughts or selfish desires. So he kind of builds this idea that love is not wanting what you don't have, love isn't taking what isn't yours, and love isn't laughing about what shouldn't be laughed about. And right up at the top, he's given us the answer. He says, therefore, be an imitator of God as a beloved child, and walk in love, as Christ gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering, and here's the big word, a sacrifice to God. True love is your needs, your preference, your comfort, your happiness over my needs, my preference, my comfort, my happiness. That the truest love is not about me at all. It is about an impossible desire to give to another person. That's what Jesus Christ gave to us on the cross. And that's what, when we give to each other, we are truly living out through sacrifice. what love actually means. That's everything for today. Hope you'll join us next week on the Harvest Bible Chapel Advent Podcast as we move from love and look at the theme of joy. See you then.